Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Bonna Pfeiffer.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for the needlework artist. And our guest this week, been wanting to do this show for quite a while now, Barbara Hudson of Queenstown Sampler Designs. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Bonna.
Thanks for doing this. Now, I've had this idea in my head for some time because we've had several sampler-oriented shows, and they almost all center around European-based and originated samplers, particularly UK. And I wanted to do a show where we talk about samplers that didn't come from Europe, and primarily American, Mexican, those kinds of things. And, of course, Barbara is the go-to person in my mind for that. So we get to do that this time. We get to talk about how samplers came to be here in the States and in Mexico and other places and some of the influences. So really excited to do this, Barbara. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Gary. I'm standing on the shoulders of many people, many scholars before me, Betty Ring and Gloria Allen and so many other people who have written wonderful books, and some of those people I've worked with to help write those books. So it's been a fine, fun journey all the way. There's many of us that have contributed. So it's been a good time.
That's why you're my go-to person, see?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
All right. And then very fortunate once again, this show is sponsored by Kim Young and Sassy Jack Stitcheries. So here is a word from Kim.
This edition of Fiber Talk is proudly sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant young needle workshop located on the picturesque Main Street of Weaverville, North Carolina. Sassy Jack's shares a beautifully renovated historic building with Five Little Monkeys Quilt Shop. We are happy to be perfectly positioned between Well-Bred Bakery, nationally recognized as one of the best small-town bakeries in the country, and Five Little Monkeys Quilt Shop, recognized as one of Western North Carolina's best locally owned shops of 2018. In fact, our little Main Street here in Weaverville, North Carolina is full of female-owned and operated local shops. We hope you come and spend a day with us and enjoy not just Sassy Jack Stitchery, but all of the wonderful talent and taste of some of Western North Carolina's best and brightest female entrepreneurs. Sassy Jack Stitchery is excited to launch our newest reproduction sampler from Sassafras Samplers, Mary Good, 1827. Mary is a sweet sampler stitched by a wonderful young embroideress. The colors are young and vibrant, and Mary's joy in her needlework, along with her diligence in stitching, both shine through. The verse is one of hope after a time of trial and tribulation, a theme we can all identify with, I'm sure. We are offering Mary Good 1827 with special kit prices that include a free custom needle nanny featuring the verse and a motif from the sampler. Many thanks to Nicola Parkman for charting Mary for us, to Jacqueline Morris for stitching the beautiful model, and to Allie Dudley for the lovely print design of the booklet. We love working with our friends on projects like this one, as it allows us to pool our talents to bring you the very best. We still have a few open spots in our September stitch soiree this year. We all have lots of projects we'd love to finish, so this is your opportunity to get away with friends for the weekend and just enjoy some stitching time without a teaching fee or another project added to your whips. Bring your stitching and join us for some frivolity and fun as we close out the summer and welcome fall here in the mountains. Cost is only $60, and you'll have the use of our wonderful classroom space, some nibbles thrown in, and some fabulous shopping at Sassy Jack's and Five Little Monkeys. Don't miss this inaugural event. You'll want to have bragging rights that you were at our very first September stitching soiree when next year rolls around. We hope you find a way to come visit us soon. If you can't make it to us, then visit us on Facebook, Instagram, or our new FlossTube channel, Sassy Jack Stitchery Yonder Ways. We love it when you stop by and say hi, whether it's in person or online. We truly appreciate you, and we really appreciate all the good things we hear and learn from Fiber Talk. We are super proud to be a sponsor of this wonderful resource of stitching goodness. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for giving us some stabby pokey talk twice a week. Kim and team at Sassy Jack Stitchery.
Thanks, Kim, and thanks for sponsoring the show. We really appreciate you making it possible to do these things on an ongoing basis. Let's just start here. Talk about the movement of samplers from Europe, UK probably in particular, the movement over to the U.S. and to this side of the world, because there's some South American work, there's plenty of Mexican. Talk about that movement, how it happened, who did what, and so on and so forth, just to give us a background of what transpired many years ago.
Well, as you know, your history will tell you that as soon as they all the people started immigrating to the Americas, they brought their families, they brought their silks, they brought their needles and their threads, and all of their motifs that they had, not just motifs, but all of their collective works with them. And they brought the type of works with them. I'm not being clear here, but let's say from in Plymouth, where some of the first settlers came, or down in Virginia, they came from England, and they came from Spain, and they came from Portugal, and they brought the motifs that they were used to there. Now, these motifs that I'm talking about have been around for thousands and thousands of years, but they've only been printed, let's say, the printing of the patterns that became more popular happened around 1520, if you were, which is about the same time that people were coming over from Europe into the Americas, 1520 or so. And the people that were, the indigenous people that were here, were already embroidering their clothes and their all their different textiles. But now you're going to have, starting in the 1520s, now you're going to have a blending of what we call pre-Columbian or the Mesoamerican, and all of the things that we're used to seeing in the European and Eastern Europe, things come together. Whether they were adopted or they were imposed on the people, it's a blend, you know.
Right. So this is a true, what we see here on this side of the world is a true embroidery melting pot, in that we just get a collection from Spain, France, the UK, and what's already here. So it really is a blending of that.
And depending on who came into what area is what you see the blending of. And some of the girls, well, let's face it, depending on the religion and whatnot, you've got convent schools, you've got mission schools, and what they were taught then. Hopefully, when the sisters or the missionaries, whoever, were teaching, they allowed the young girls or whoever they were teaching to also use some of their pre-colonial or the when I say Mesoamerican, it's the early things, the culture, the things from their culture that they were used to. So when we're looking at some of the Mexican samplers, you can see maybe an Aztec-looking man or a woman, or Aztec-looking bird that you see on things that were thousands of years old, that were carved in stone and whatnot, blended in with flowers from France that you would see on a sampler from like 1860 or so. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on what area of the Americas that you're talking about, because again, with the history lesson, the Pope decided who would get where in South America. So you've got Portugal and Brazil combining things there, and then Spain and the rest of South America combining their cultures.
Yeah, and you use that word imposed, and that is a real factor, in that the Catholic Church, in its outreach across the world with its schools and nuns, there really was an imposition of designs then.
And culture, and yes, they thought they were helping out, but hopefully a good teacher blended the cultures.
And be careful, Vanna's very Catholic, so be careful.
Well, Vanna, I'm a recovering Catholic, so
I'm Lutheran, we're just mad, so.
Yeah, I went to convent school, so yeah, I know. It's all good.
But so that really does become a factor, in that we're teaching these little girls on this side of the world how to stitch and what to stitch, But then they have their own culture. And, of course, the natural thing is, yeah, but I want, these are what the designs, the colors that I'm used to. This is what is on our clothes and how our artwork is done. And I want to incorporate that.
Well, you'll see in the Central American schoolgirl samplers and even some of the clothes that are still being produced today, honoring their customs and whatnot. A wonderful blend of brilliant colors that you would see in the tropics, and they continue to use, along with some European influences too. And again, a blend of techniques and whatnot. I can remember a little story that Kathleen Staples gave a talk in the 90s, and she was talking about someone where she read that early on peasants from the mountains came down to the convent to learn the stitching. These were men that came down to watch the nuns stitch, because not all the children could come down to learn to school. So they were watching the nuns do this stitching, and they took back the idea to the women and the girls and the other people in the village. And what happened was, the women who were learning from the men were just, you've got a verbal teaching thing going on here, not a visual. And so what happened is they're learning to do a cross stitch, and they're learning to do it in a long arm way. And what comes back is something completely reversible on the back side.
Mm-hmm.
And today you've got and it's not the way that the nuns were stitching it. It's the way that the indigenous people were stitching it, because they wanted it, well, of course, as neat as possible. And this is how they figured out how to do it. They ended all their threads on the front. I don't know if that story is true or whatnot, but it was a cute way of telling us that they had their own ways already of how to embroider, and they incorporated what they were being shown by the nuns, even though they weren't physically there. They were going by whatever their husbands were telling them. Again, I don't know if the story is really true, but it's a cute little story.
I love that. I love the arrogance of men. We'll go learn from the nuns, and we'll come back and tell you how to do it. Yeah. Okay.
The first mansplained story I've ever heard. Can you imagine?
Jeez.
But it was beautiful work, and they, on Mexican samplers, most of the work is reversible, and you get little tiny stitches. I sent you some photos of front and back on some of these antique samplers from Mexico, and it's fabulous how the workmanship is just wonderful. And anymore, after years ago, after I learned how to do reversible stitching, working the Laura Standish from Joanne Harvey kit back in the early 90s, and then learning more about Mexican samplers and how they figured out the techniques, I'm just fascinated by reversible stitching. And it was great to learn. I don't do it so much anymore, because I did it back then, and I know how. And if I need to, I can do it. But it's
Vanna's absolutely married to it. She just loves it. So
I don't know that I would go that far, but I do find it. I'm like you. It's just like, how did they come up with this? How did they figure that out? And I was telling Gary the other day, we're doing this queen sampler, and it's all reversible, and I've never been exposed to any classes or anything like that. So I have figured it out largely on my own. And it's like, I went to cross stitch just a simple ornament for that I'm finishing for a magazine. And it's like, I told Gary, it's like, I was like starting to stitch it reversibly. And I was like, wait a minute. I don't have to stitch this reversibly. But I had to like really sit and think about how to do just a normal cross stitch, because I have been doing reversible cross stitch for so long. So
let's talk about Mexican samplers, Barbara, because if you put a bunch of samplers out in a room, the Mexican ones will just scream.
Yes. Stand out.
It's not hard to figure those out. So, and then you sent some where there's even some cut work in them.
Yes. I'm not sure who coined the term Aztec stitch. I thought it was Kathy Staples, but she said no, she heard it from somebody else. The stitch is, you start by preparing the outlined area that you're going to be doing with either a four-sided stitch or with a nun stitch or with a buttonhole or just plain satin stitch, because what you need to stabilize that area, and you need an area where you can hide your threads on the, you know, start and finish your threads. And then you do you cut some linen threads, not all of them, there's some of them, think of hardanger, if you will, that kind of idea. And what you're going to do is you're going to wrap what's left in a specific design and the different color combinations. You can create different kinds of lace. You're creating needle lace is what you're creating, and there will be holes and whatnot. And then I sent you another sampler that has a different type of technique where you don't remove any linen threads, and you just lay the thread over the, you know, on the linen and kind of pull it a little bit, more of a pulled work technique than the cut work technique. And I think it's just beautiful. And I'm not alone here. We've only seen that kind of work on the Aztec, on the Mexican samplers. And when we say Mexico, this could also be into, you know, like Texas and New Mexico and whatnot. This is, you know, areas of the United States too, but mostly Central America.
Yeah, we have to remember back in those days, there was not... there was not Texas, or it was just land. Yeah. Do you think that was that cut work was indigenous?
That I don't know for sure. I don't. Something they figured out. Maybe it was something that they saw the different kind of lace work and how do I make that? And let's, you know, did something they saw someone else do. It could be. I don't know. I don't want to guess.
Yeah. Well, that's such a particular technique that, mm-hmm. I mean, it has to originate somewhere. And of course, when it comes to hardanger, we think about,
Norway,
and it seems like a stretch all the way to Mexico to get that kind of thing. So,
well, you know, it's not too much of a stretch. I'm going to tell you another Norway story. You see the beautiful, well, there's different areas of Norway. They have different embroideries also in each section of Norway. And they have some wonderful freestyle, the big flowers with the satin stitch.
Mm-hmm.
You also see that in Hungary, in Europe. And the reason you see it in Hungary and Europe is that 1,000 years before Hungary was doing it, the Norwegians were doing it, but then there was a war, and the Hungarian king or whoever, the Ottoman prince or whoever was in charge at the time, paid mercenaries from Norway to come and help them fight their war, and they brought their families.
Oh.
They brought their embroidery to Hungary. So that's where Hungary got it. So I have all this dumb information in my head. I'm sorry. It just kind of floats out.
But see that to me is so fascinating, because, you know, for all the ugly things of war, to have that be a transfer of culture and art,
mm-hmm.
is interesting. And that's the one thing that goes through my head whenever these discussions about samplers is the motifs. And you mentioned about that motifs getting hauled over here to the U.S., to the Americas, and then getting incorporated. And I just wonder I'm sure people have tried it, tracing particular motifs and see, you know, trying to figure out how they got around the world.
Again, with the Mexican samplers, I don't know if, I know we spoke about this a little bit before we started our interview, but Dr. Lynn Anderson has done a paper on Mexican samplers, their motifs, materials, and text. Well, with the integration of the indigenous motifs and with the things that came in from Europe and other areas of the world for a blend. And she talks about one thing in particular that I find fascinating in that the double-headed eagle, you see that on the Mexican flag and, or no, not the double-headed, that's the eagle with the snake. But the double-headed eagle is also considered part Mexican and then part Ottoman Empire or Habsburg Empire. And actually, that double-headed eagle has been around for thousands of years before that in Turkey and in Persia and that area, too. So it's hard to claim one motif from one area when there's been such a blending of cultures over the thousands of years we've been around keeping track of this kind of stuff.
But that's, to me, that's what's so interesting about it is that you can find it in so many places and find it in places so long ago that to travel anywhere was measured in days and weeks and months. Mm-hmm. And to have that carried, and then people hauling embroidery with them when for most of them travel was, do we have enough food and water? And
it's important to have a needle and thread too if you want to stay clothed.
That's true.
And why not make it pretty, you know, with a little bit of embroidery?
What is it about Mexican sampler in terms of the materials? Is it still silk and linen? What do you see in terms of the materials they used?
Well, it was mostly silk and linen. The cotton threads really weren't even invented to embroider with, thick enough to embroider with until the 1840s. Up until then, actually, in the mid-18th century, if you were wearing a cotton dress, it was more expensive than a silk embroidered dress because it was just so difficult to attain, to get that kind of fabric made. So you figure Colonial Williamsburg time, 1770, if you've got a plain cotton dress, that's going to be more expensive than, like I said, an embroidered silk dress. But yeah, silks, mostly. I've got some, that's why I can date some of my samplers, because they were made out of cotton, so I know they were made after 1840.
Oh.
So that's one way of figuring out a date. And then when they start using the wools that are overdyed and whatnot with the the fake colors, not the natural colors. Anodyne? No. Oh, well. You all know what I mean. natural dyes. Those colors are rather kind of garish, so you can date that to after a certain time period. Sometimes there's a mixture, because of silks and wools. Now, not all wools had the finer wools that had the nice natural dyes. That's as early as the early 1700s. Some of those fine merino wools were being dyed for embroidery and what people call crewel work, and canvas work. So,
it looks like in the photos of the original Mexican samplers that the colors have held up particularly well. I mean, they still have a good deal of brightness and intensity to them. Is that dyes that others didn't have?
It's possible. It's also the number one reason was probably because these textiles were put away from the light and not exposed to light, not exposed to temperatures that variate. I haven't found too many samplers survive in Central America and South America, Northern South America, because of the high temperatures, the humidity and whatnot. Mm. I know they're there. I haven't seen them, but I can imagine that, they haven't been kept in air conditioning.
Yeah.
Unless someone found them and put them in a museum.
So then samplers that originated in the more desert climates then are naturally going to survive better.
They are, although some textiles have been found that were in mud, if you will, that were carbonated and survived that way. go figure. I don't know. I'm not a chemist and I'm not, but I've read that that's happened. So
And Mexican samplers fairly readily available. I mean, it seems to me that I'll ask this bigger question. When we look at samplers as a whole, it seems to me like there's an endless supply from Europe of samplers of age of really of anything. But then do I read it right that when it comes to American and Mexican and samplers from this side of the world, that they are not as readily available or as in as good a condition?
Well, I don't know. It just depends on.
Go ahead, say you're wrong, Gary. It's okay.
No. There's a lot of different factors to take in, because there's plenty of American samplers that none of us have even seen, and they're just now starting to pop up because, sadly, the descendants don't want them anymore or don't know who they were, so they don't feel a family connection to them. Like so many have in the past, they've kept that as a family treasure, and it's cyclic too, because some young people today don't care as much about antique furniture and other antiques. That's why you see a downtrend in sales on. If you listen or watch the Antique Roadshow, and they have one of those shows from 10 years ago and into now, and whether the price has gone up or down, and any more like furniture, that's gone, that the prices on that have gone way down. But I'm happy to say I've been watching, and textiles are staying the same or going up. So embroidered ones anyways.
Yeah. The kids don't want the old stuff. Yeah. We're working on emptying the house. They don't want it.
Yeah. And my kids don't want my antiques. no, I shouldn't say that. Some of them do want my antiques and they value them. Not all of them, but yeah. But to answer your question, it just, they're there and they're more are coming out. The Mexican samplers for a while there, they were popping up all over the place. You can go to online to several museums that have online collections, like the Museum of Fine Arts Baltimore has quite a few Mexican samplers, as does the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And the Met actually has over 1,000 samplers online. I forget how many the others do. You'll find them. The Folk Art Museum of the International Folk Art Museum in New Mexico, Santa Fe, has quite a few samplers, although most of them are not online. But if you're ever in Santa Fe, you must go to that museum and see their sampler wall, because they have a lot of samplers on display. More European, I think, than the Mexican-American ones. But they have more in the back in their
to get in the back rooms of some of those museums. Oh,
oh yes. That's a joy when I get to do that.
Yeah.
But usually people have to realize if that's something they want to do and contact the museum, realize that it's a lot for the museums to get all that stuff out. Mm-hmm. And so maybe well in advance, contact them just to see if that's something that they would be willing to do. And you could make a donation to the museum or come in as a group, so that it's not just, you know, one person going, you know, you're doing this for one person, you're doing it for maybe a group of, you know, between around 10 people or something, and they're probably more happy to do that.
Yeah. Talk about American samplers. You're kind of, at least my sense is, in the hotbed of samplers. I mean, there's just an awful lot of activity around you, several people. And then Pennsylvania, also a kind of a focus for samplers.
Oh yes, a hotbed for samplers. There are so many schools in Pennsylvania, especially Southeast Pennsylvania, but other areas too, and different counties, if you will. We'll go by counties; it's a little bit easier. Or cities. Philadelphia was one of the mainstays early on in the early 1700s for some of the best schools to learn, for girls to be sent to learn embroidery. The number what I think is one of the most premier schools was the Elizabeth Marsh School. The Marsh family came to Philadelphia in the early 1720s, and Elizabeth Marsh and her daughter Anne taught for many decades. Anne Marsh taught well into the 1780s. She died in the late 1790s. She had retired by then to Chester County, but her work is just phenomenal. Winterthur Museum has quite a few of her things, as does the Chester County Historical Society have a lot of her personal embroidered items. But those samplers continue to live on in the students, and they continued. The students of Elizabeth and Anne Marsh started their own schools, and you can see the progression of the motifs into other schools, into other areas of Pennsylvania too, into Germantown and Bucks County and Berks County and Chester County, all over. It just spread like wildfire, and beautiful, beautiful work from Philadelphia area, and
still being used as an education piece and a means of demonstrating skill, as they were in Europe. Or were they more art?
Skill and art together.
Okay.
I consider it both, but yes, skill.
Still, okay.
Still. Up until the, I would say, 1830s is when they started being more of a diploma, if you will, into marriage. But before that, it was learning the skill and teaching and having a vocation in some respects. Because the girls that went to school, their parents paid a lot of money to send them to school, and they were merchants, well-to-do farmers. They were, I don't want to say the most upper class, because they didn't always send their children to school. Some of them had teachers come to them, kind of thing too. Mm-hmm. But it's an I think samplers are an important, they prove that the girls were taught, parents cared enough about their both of the boys and girls so that they could get a good education.
Help me understand in Pennsylvania, and again, maybe I'm completely clueless here, the Quaker style samplers versus more conventional, whatever that is, samplers.
Okay.
Are there two distinct channels there, or is there always a blend? How did that work?
Well, prior to the last decade of the 18th century, so we're looking at the 1790s, when more Quaker schools were being built. Prior to that last decade, mothers and fathers were sending their children to really high quality schools for these girls to learn gorgeous, gorgeous embroideries, not just simple. All of a sudden, in the 1780s, the ministers, the Quaker ministers, were starting to tell people they needed to be more simple, more, you know, not quite as fancy. They wanted plain work. And so that's what was starting to be taught at these new schools out there. Prior to that, they were the finer embroideries, such as my Ruth Passmore, who was taught by her aunt, Susanna Pusey Harvey, who had her own school in conjunction with the Wilmington School in Delaware, but hers was more of a private school. And she taught fine, fine needlework, not just simplified things. She taught simple things too, because you have to learn you have to learn a marking sampler first. If you will, the alphabet, a few basic stitches, and then you move on to something more elaborate, which most of these girls did. But there was a thing going on with the Quakers that you had to simplify things. That's why you saw more simple little religious verses, little cartouches, just then the and you've got just those medallion motifs that were coming out of the Netherlands and, of course, the up in Yorkshire, the Ackworth School, Quaker samplers and other schools too throughout the United States too. But it was a concerted effort on the ministers that time to simplify and not make it so fancy. And then there was a backlash on a lot of the women who wanted to learn, still learn, and teach, have their daughters taught the nicer embroideries too. So that's why so many more private schools were doing well too. And the Quaker schools, it's not always easy to find information out about them because they didn't have to advertise. It was just word of mouth at the yearly meetings, the yearly Quaker meetings, or the monthly meetings, and everyone knew each other. And then either they were related or knew them through the Quaker meeting, and that's how they continued to have the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make any sense?
Yes. Well, okay. See, it's you know, there's that religion again dictating art. Of course, at the time it was more functional stitching, but still dictating art, and then that natural resistance to don't tell me how to do with needle and thread. You know, I want to be more creative. I mean, that's the way at least that it sounds to me, and sadly, again, it's men dictating how it's going to be done.
and then you have the mix up in the latter part of the 1820s when the Quakers kind of broke there, and it was quite a traumatic break for them. They broke off into two different groups, and not that it, you know, the embroidery had anything to do with it, but
the Great Embroidery War of 17.
Yeah, the Hicksites and the Orthodox. Yeah, all over embroidery. I don't think so, but it might have had something to do with it. If it had been me, yeah, I would have been all about that. But you see, after 1826, you see more of the fanciful embroideries coming back into the Quaker schools. But it doesn't last much more than a couple decades after that embroidery taught in schools. Up when you get closer to the American Civil War, it's not being taught in many schools at all anymore, hardly at all, sadly.
It just kind of died off?
Well, no, it didn't die off. It's just that it became more important, the thing is, with a lot of the schools, a lot of the better schools that I'm aware of, the girls didn't just learn embroidery. They learned the same thing that the boys were learning on top of the embroidery. The embroidery was added.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, supplies for the embroidery and teaching the embroidery cost more money than a year's worth of boarding. You know, it was double the cost for teaching a young woman her embroidery skills on top of the other skills. So I've been able to when you read the book on Quaker samplers by Mary Brooks, which is called Threads of Useful Learning, Westtown School Samplers, she goes into detail somewhat on what the girls had to learn during the day. And then when I worked with the archivist Sharon Connect on the Mary Pett sampler, and I was privileged to see a lot of the daily journals that the girls, their curriculum and what they had to do once they learned the actual stitches. They were only given an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening to work on their samplers. During the day, they had all the other things that you needed to do, math, geography, history, all of that. So it's amazing what the girls could get done in a short amount of time.
That's Vanna and my schedules, an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening, and the rest of the day is madness.
Exactly.
Before I quit my other paying job years ago, that's all I would do was in the morning, an hour before I went to work, and then an hour in the evening if I was lucky. So, yeah.
And then what was happening in your area, in the Baltimore area, different or just similar and in a different area?
Just similar, There were a lot more schools. The book that I helped research, A Maryland Sampling, A Maryland Sampling by Gloria Seaman Allen. I've been part of her crew since the mid-90s, researching samplers. And we found there's, well, in the middle 90s, she and I had a list of 13 known samplers and just a handful of teachers for the state of Maryland. By the time we were done researching the book, we knew of over 900 samplers and dozens of teachers. So there were quite a few. Again, Baltimore had quite a few different schools. We don't know the names of all of them because the girls did not put the teachers' names on some of the samplers. And I know we were going to get to the Baltimore eyeglass gate. That's just one type of sampler. But that eyeglass gate, the gate and the house, the brick house and whatnot.
Yeah, what is that? Tell, what is that? Eyeglass gate.
Eyeglass gate, if you were to look at either the Ann Barrier sampler that I reproduced, which is in the collection of the Maryland Historical Society, or the Mary Petts, which is in the collection of the Oblate Sisters of Providence, that is was actually done by a young African-American girl. Her mother was free. She was free. This was in 1830 or 31, I forget. I can't see it from across the room here. But you've got brickwork house, big house, architectural house. Then there's a fencing, there's poles, it's usually green. And then there's two main brick parts of the gate, if you will. And if you look at it, like the metalwork of the gate, little round, not circular, but ovals.
Oh, that's kind of the eyeglass.
That's the eyeglass.
Oh.
And we know that they started around being taught about 1809. And we know all the way up to the 1840s, 1841, 42, something like that. There were different schools teaching this, obviously, you know, the Oblate Sisters and then the other one. But there, we think there were at least a half a dozen different schools teaching this. So someone taught it in the very beginning, and then they continued to be a teacher, and they opened up their own school kind of thing. But what it proves, too, is that everyone in that area, well, not everyone, excuse me, I don't mean to exaggerate, the schools that we are aware of, there was no differentiating between the African-American school or the white school, or it didn't matter. They would be all being taught the same high skills.
Yeah, because this Mary Petts one, that that was African-American girl, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. We know that she, I'll go back a little bit. In the spring of 1828, four women of African descent became a women's religious order in Baltimore, and they started a school. And for colored, well, at the time it was called the Oblate Sisters for Colored Girls, all right? Mm-hmm. And they... And many of the graduates went on to make their living through sewing, even up until the 1960s. The school was still in existence today. But up until the 1960s, it was needlework that was helping run the convent, and the nuns and the sisters got a lot of their income that way, just doing needlework, fine needlework. So it's kind of neat.
Yeah, well, sure, it's neat. Yeah, now that Mary Petts one, is that all cross stitch? That doesn't appear to be. It's hard to tell from the picture, but
well, the little animals are satin stitched, but for the most part, it is cross stitch.
Is it okay?
The house, she did not do an easy thing here on the house, and I do a separate chart for just the house. She skipped a thread to show you the mortar and the bricks. That's not stitched, but so it's.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I know, but it's a big chart. It's okay once you understand what I had to tell you.
But pay attention.
Well, and what's unique on the Mary Petts is that big bird. It's a big blue striped bird. None of the other eyeglass gates has a bird like that ever. That I've seen.
Hmm.
And
So you could actually do a book then, it sounds like, with just eyeglass gate samplers and be able to identify most of them with schools all around your area.
In and around Baltimore. That's where they mostly worked on. So that was Ann Barrier, Mary Petz, and then we have the Jordan sisters, Ann and Elizabeth. Ann actually put, not a house, but put a big round, a folly on it.
And you have quite a collection. So talk about another one you have is Ruth Passmore. You've mentioned her a couple of times.
I did. Ruth Passmore was the niece of Susanna Pusey Harvey, the teacher, or preceptress, as she was called. She was the head of the school. So that word means not only someone in charge of teaching your child history and needlework, but she's also in charge of teaching her morals and that kind of thing. So, but that sampler is just one of my favorites. It has clusters of tulips and flowers, and Ruth tells us who her parents are and who her brothers and sisters were. In fact, she didn't finish her work, even though in 1804, because she adds her younger siblings' names to it, who were born well after 1804. So it had been a while since she did that, finished it off. But Susanna Pusey Harvey, the name of her school on the samplers that you see from that school say B-Wine. B-Wine School, short for Brandywine School.
Oh.
So she was the one that she actually was teaching in Lancaster County in the late 18th century, in the 1790s. And then she moved to Wilmington in 1800. And we know this because of the Quakers and their great records.
Yeah.
Because she started going to the monthly meeting in Wilmington in 1800. So, and then we found some papers from her, not Ruth, but another niece that she lived with after her marriage, after her husband died. She was living with her niece, and the paperwork said that she continued to teach when she was much, much older in a local meeting house in Pennsylvania, in Chester County.
You have another one, J.M. Mears. And Vonna, do I remember, do you have that one?
I don't have it, no.
I must be confusing that with another one that you have.
No, I love this one. This is the one that I talked about on Sampler Sunday.
I thought you had brought that up, and see, a professional would have looked that up, but you know.
Yeah, I love this one.
When I first saw that sampler, I've always called it the big house sampler because, mm-hmm. there's not a bigger house than that sampler has.
It's a beautiful sampler. I saw it. I think the first time I ever saw it was like in 2012, and I love it. And you want to know where I saw it, Gary? Nicole stitched it.
Really?
Yes, she stitched it and finished it in 2012, and I took a screenshot of it, and I do that, you know, a lot of times I'll take screenshots of things that I just find beautiful, and it comes up on my feed, on my rotating feed of when my computer's on, you know, silent or whatever, and I'll see it and I just think, oh gosh, I love that. I just love the whole sampler. I just love it. I love the alphabet. I love the colors of it. But the real thing is that house and that, or whatever it is. Is it a castle? It says that it's a castle, I believe.
It does. And that drove me crazy trying to figure out what she was talking about, because I know who she was. I know she was from the Eastern Shore of Virginia, and they don't have Roseshire castles there at all.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was able to figure out at that time period, they were, they being people in general, were giving false names to things. Mm-hmm. Like it could be a drawing of something, and they would just give it any old name. Now, that house appears on a couple other samplers from that school. And I got to tell you that sampler on a whole was being taught in around the early 1810s, 1811s, down in Suffolk County, around James River and Williamsburg. And even before that, even a decade before that, a simpler version was being made. And if you have Kimberly Smith Ivey's book, In the Neatest Manner, The Making of the Virginia Sampler Tradition, which is out of print, but you can still get copies of it. On the very cover of that book, you will see the exact same sampler as Elizabeth J.M. Mears made 20 years later with a different house. Yeah. And, but you, the fences down there, all the different flowers and the fruit baskets, but it was Elizabeth Mears that actually named her fruit. I hadn't seen that before. Just recently, just last year, another one of these samplers with the same house that's on Kim Ivey's book came up for auction. And I hurried up and I let her know about it. And she was able to buy it for Colonial Williamsburg Foundation to add to their collection. They have about, they must have at least half a dozen or more in their collection of just this exact sampler. Couple different styles, not styles, but a couple different, the evolution, if you will, from real simple and how it changed over the time period all around the James River. And then when I found mine, my Elizabeth Mears, what was it, 2010, that was a big jump and a big deal. And I couldn't wait to tell Kim about it. So to add to our knowledge, and we found a few more since then from the Eastern Shore. So but the name, Rose, what does it say? The front view of Anne Castle, Roseshire, England. First of all, there is no Roseshire, England. Okay. Anyone can do that. So, you know, it's, and then there's no Anne Castle. There's Anne Arundel, is how they say it in England. We say in Maryland, we say Anne Arundel, but, you know, it's the same woman. They're just different ways of saying it. Because I've got a county here where Annapolis, Maryland is. The county is called Anne Arundel. And it's,
Yep, nope. Been through there many a time on business trips. Yep.
Yep. So, well, you were close to me. Next time you come through, you'll have to let me know.
Because I will that.
I'm just over the bay.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll hunt you down because I do get there every now and then. Yes. Yes. I wanted to, we're going to run out of time here, and you have, you know, getting away from the Americas here, you have a pair of sister samplers from Uruguay.
Okay. They're not my personal.
Oh, they're not yours. Okay. Well, I want them to be yours.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't buy them. They were on Amy Finkel's website. That's samplings.com. And she recently sold them to some lucky person, but they our sister samplers from, and the girls were from Uruguay, and the type of samplers that they are, if I didn't know they were from Uruguay, I would have said they were either Spanish or Portuguese or Belgium or even Italian, because that type of sampler being done in, and they're dated 1822 and 1823, so typical of a blend of European styles, if you will. Up in the inside the border, up in the corner, each of them has what is called the crisscross row. And it's called a crisscross row because it starts with a four-sided cross. And what the young girls were taught in convent school was you always start with a crisscross row. That crisscross is, and Vanna, you'll understand, is a prayer. If you as you're stitching that symbol, you are asking God to help you with your works and your daily life, and that's what that's all about.
Vanna, that's the same symbol that's the first one in the Queen sampler, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Yes. Now that just took that little beast, but that just took on meaning for it, because that was nasty. That was a nasty way to start. That was to reversibly stitch that thing. So that actually has meaning there, because I wondered who would put that in the upper corner.
Yeah.
So it has some history to it. See, that's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yep.
Did you know that when you stitched it, Vonna?
I didn't know it when I stitched it, but I read it in recently because I've been like really researching, Gary, you know, like I'm trying to be like top notch here. I read it recently.
Show off.
I read it recently and I thought, oh, that's something, because I'll tell you something. I don't put a snowflake in the top, but I was always taught by the nuns when I went to Catholic school that when you take a test or anything that you're worried about, you put JMJ at the top of your top left-hand corner of your work, and that Jesus Mary stands for Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and that they will help you take your test.
Oh.
Well, the whole idea is that you are taking a few minutes of inner thought and thinking about what is going to come. Yeah, it's a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I usually take a few minutes to kick myself for not studying, but okay. Whatever works.
Well,
so that row then, see, this is the part I just love this stuff. So then that row, then you're starting that with that in mind as you begin the sampler then.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And on the sampler, you'll see different things. It doesn't have many things from the Passions of Christ, different motifs, but it has a few here. The Christ robe, and we're talking about the sister samplers from Uruguay again.
Right.
And then you've got the spinning monkey too. Interesting combination there. And a boat on one of them. Then you've got Caleb and Joshua, the wine carriers.
Yeah, these have, and folks, there'll be pictures on WeTalkFiber.com for this podcast for all these, so you can study them and see them. And then most of the others that we've talked about, you can go to Barbara's site and see them there. But yeah, these have a different flavor to them. The font design on the letters, it just seems different.
It's maybe different to you, Gary, but it's very familiar to me looking at it as I've seen many Italian samplers with the same font.
And
Belgium also. If you go to samplings.com and just in her search area, you put in Uruguay sisters or Uruguay, these samplers will pop up, and you can read much more about the sisters and their connection with Uruguay. In fact, one of the sampler maker's brothers was elected president of Uruguay. I don't remember too much else there, but she has quite a bit of information on them, just like I have information. The Mercedes Ospina sampler from Colombia, she was the daughter of the president of that country too. So that's the one all in red that people like.
Yeah, that's a Vonna style one there.
Yeah,
which one?
Ospina.
Which one?
Ospina.
Oh, yeah. That is true. I looked at that. Is a Vonna one.
Yeah, I saw that, and I knew you were drooling right out of the gate on that one.
Yeah.
It really is beautiful. You know, for a single color sampler, it is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That has a neat combination of motifs also, because there's a little bit of indigenous motifs there, but mostly it's French, not Spanish, but French nuns that taught Mercedes there in Medellin, Colombia, the Carmelite sisters. And you'll notice too, Vanna, if you look, the Carmelite sisters symbol, which is a hill with a tall cross, it's on that sampler. There's also 19 dogs. She must have liked dogs. And
there are 19 dogs in that thing.
There are 19. And in fact, a portion of the sales of that sampler, I give to the wounded warriors who supply dogs for wounded warriors. So, every time that sampler is sold, the wholesale price, I send a piece of it to that group. Just because.
Well, that's terrific. Well, that's beautiful. Yep. Vonna's ordering it right now. That's why she went quiet. She's ordering it.
Yeah. When I first saw that sampler, I was confused because it didn't have a Spanish alphabet. It had English, French, And as soon as I found out where she went to school at that convent, then it all was clear to me. Because at the time, the Carmelite nuns were based in France in 1863.
So, Barbara, we got to stop. I'll see you. Okay. And of course, that means you got to come back. So, as I got more stuff, but boy, this is just thank you for doing this. Really, I learned a lot. That's great.
Well, it was fun.
Thanks. You know? Yes.
So, yeah, we will do it again. Sure.
Okay. All right. Counting on that. All right. Thanks to Sassy Jacks for sponsoring. Thanks to Barbara. And go see all the stuff at Queenstown-Sampler-Designs.com is where Barbara has all of her designs. And you can get them, you're wholesale, so people get them through the shops then.
That's correct.
Yeah, get the designs through the shops. And she was talking before we started recording about new stuff. Well, new stuff coming up for Nashville, so buckle up for that. All right, thanks, Barbara. Thanks to Sassy Jackson. Thanks for listening.